purchase was denied. It says wrong credit card number. He considered. That could be. I'm always reversing two of the digits. Sometimes even when I have the damn card right beside the keyboard, I'm a little dyslexic. But the order went through anyway, Don said thoughtfully. Somehow, to someone, somewhere. What does the Kindle say we're in? Refresh me on that. Wesley went back to the relevant screen. 117,586. Only to enter that as a choice, you omit the comma. Don said, that might not be the we're living in, but I bet it was the this Kindle came from. In that the MasterCard number you gave is the right one for the Wesley Smith that exists there. What are the odds of something like that happening? Robbie asked. I don't know, Don said, but probably a lot steeper than 10.4 million to one. Wesley opened his mouth to say something and was interrupted by a fusillade of knocks on the door. They all jumped. Don Allman actually uttered a little scream. Who is it? Wesley asked, grabbing the Kindle and holding it protectively to his chest. Janitor? The voice on the other side of the door said. You folks ever going home? It's almost 7 o'clock and I need to lock up the building. 4. News Archive. They weren't done. Couldn't be done. Not yet. Wesley, in particular, was anxious to press on. Although he hadn't slept for more than 3 hours at a stretch in days, he felt wide awake, energized. He and Robbie walked back to his apartment while Don went home to help his wife put the boys to bed. When that was done, he joined them at Wesley's place for an extended skull session. Wesley said he'd order some food.
Good, Don said, but be careful. Chinese just doesn't taste the same.
For a wonder, Wesley found he could actually laugh. So this is what an English instructor's apartment looks like, Robbie said, gazing around. Man, I dig all the books. Good, Wesley said. I loan to people who bring back. Keep it in mind. I will. My parents have never been, you know, great readers. A few magazines, some diet books, a self-help manual or two. That's all. I might have been the same way if not for you. Just banging my head out on the football field, you know, with nothing ahead except maybe teaching P.E. in Giles County. That's in Tennessee. Yeehaw. Wesley was touched by this. Probably because he'd been hurled through so many emotional hoops just lately. Thanks, he said. Just remember, there's nothing wrong with a good loud yeehaw. That's part of who you are, too. Both parts are equally valid. He thought of Ellen ripping deliverance out of his hands and hurling it across the room. And why? Because she hated books? No, because he hadn't been listening when she needed him to. Hadn't it been Fritz Leiber, the great fantasist and science fiction writer, who had called books the scholar's mistress? And when Ellen needed him, hadn't he been in the arms of his other lover, the one who made no demands other than on his vocabulary, and always took him in. Wes, what were those other things on the functions menu? At first, Wesley didn't know what the kid was talking about. Then he remembered that there had been a couple of other items. He'd been so fixated on the books submenu that he had forgotten the other two. Well, let's see, he said, and turned the Kindle on. Every time he did this, he expected either the experimental menu or the functions menu to be gone. That would also happen in a fantasy story or a Twilight Zone episode. But they were still right there. News Archive and Local, Robbie said. Huh. Local's under construction. Better watch out, traffic fines double. What? Never mind. Just goofing with you. Try the News Archive. Wesley selected it. The screen blanked. After a few moments, a message appeared. Welcome to the News Archive. Only the New York Times is available at this time. Your price is $1, 4 downloads. $10, 50 downloads. $100, 800 downloads. Select with cursor, your account will be billed. Wesley looked at Robbie, who shrugged. I can't tell you what to do, but
If my credit card wasn't being billed, in this world anyway, I'd spend the 100. Wesley thought he had a point, although he wondered what the other Wesley, if indeed there was one, was going to think when he opened his next MasterCard bill. He highlighted the $100, 800 line and pushed the select button. This time the paradox laws didn't come up. Instead, the new message invited him to choose date and use appropriate fields.
You do it, he said, and pushed the Kindle across the kitchen table to Robbie.
This was getting easier to do, and he was glad, and obsession about keeping the Kindle in his own hands was a complication he didn't need, understandable as it was. Robbie thought for a moment, then typed in January 21st, 2009. In the field, he selected 100000.
$1 million, he said. Why not?
And pushed the button. The screen went blank, then produced a message reading, "Enjoy your selection." A moment later, the front page of the New York Times appeared. They bent over the screen, reading silently until there was a knock at the door.
"That'll be Don," Wesley said. "I'll let him in."
Robbie Henderson didn't reply. He was still transfixed.
"Getting cold out there," Don said as he came in. "And there's a wind knocking all the leaves off the..."
He studied Wesley's face.
"What? Or should I say, what now?"
"Come and see," Wesley said.
Don went into Wesley's book-lined living room study, where Robbie remained bent over the Kindle. The kid looked up and turned the screen so Don could see it. There were blank patches where the photos should have gone, each with the message, "Image unavailable." But the headline was big and black. "Now it's her turn." And below it, the subhead, "Hillary Clinton takes oath, assumes role as 44th president."
"Looks like she made it after all," Wesley said. "At least in her 1 million.
"And check out who she's replacing," Robbie said, and pointed to the name. It was Albert Arnold Gore. An hour later, when the doorbell rang, they didn't jump, but rather looked around like men startled from a dream. Wesley went downstairs and paid the delivery guy, who had arrived with a loaded pizza from Harry's and a six-pack of Pepsi. They ate at the kitchen table, bent over the Kindle. Wesley put away three slices himself, a personal best, with no awareness of what he was eating. They didn't use up the 800 downloads they had ordered, nowhere near it, but in the next 4 hours they skimmed enough stories from various errs to make their heads ache. Wesley felt as though his mind were aching. From the nearly identical looks he saw on the faces of the other two, pale cheeks, avid eyes in bruised sockets, crazed hair, he guessed he wasn't alone. Looking into one alternate reality would have been challenging enough. Here were over 10 million, and although most appeared to be similar, not one was exactly the same. The inauguration of the 44th President of the United States was only one example, but a powerful one. They checked it in 24 different errs before getting tired and moving on. Fully 17 front pages on January 21st of 2009 announced Hillary Clinton as the new president. In 14 of them, Bill Richardson of New Mexico was her vice president. In 2, it was Joe Biden. In 1, it was a senator none of them had heard of, Linwood Speck of New Jersey.
"He always says no when someone else wins a top spot," Don said.
"Who always says no?" Robbie asked. "Obama?"
"Yeah, he always gets asked, and he always says no."
"It's in character," Wesley said, "and while events change, character never seems to."
"You can't say that for sure," Don said. "We have a minuscule sample compared to the,
he laughed feebly,
"you know, the whole thing. All the worlds of err."
Barack Obama had been elected in 6 errs. Mitt Romney had been elected once, with John McCain as his running mate. He had run against Obama, who had been tapped after Hillary was killed in a motorcade accident late in the campaign. They saw not a single mention of Sarah Palin. Wesley wasn't surprised.
He thought that if they stumbled on her, it would be more by luck than by probability, and not just because Mitt Romney showed up more often as the Republican nominee than John McCain did. Palin had always been an outsider, a long shot, the one nobody expected. Robbie wanted to check the Red Sox. Wesley felt it was a waste of time, but Don came down on the kid's side, so Wesley agreed. The two of them checked the sports pages for October in 10 different errors, plugging in dates from 1918 to 2009.
"This is depressing," Robbie said after the 10th try.
Don Allman agreed.
"Why?"
Wesley asked.
"They win lots of times."
"But there's no rhyme or reason to it," Robbie said.
"And no curse," Don said. "They always win just enough to avoid it, which is sort of boring."
"What curse?" Wesley was mystified. Don opened his mouth to explain, then sighed.
"Never mind," he said. "It would take too long and you wouldn't get it anyway."
"Look on the bright side," Robbie said. "The Yankees are always there, so it isn't all luck."
"Yeah," Don said glumly. "The military-industrial complex of the sporting world."
"Sorry. Does anyone want that last slice?"
Don and Wes shook their heads. Robbie scarfed it and said,
"Why not check the big casino before we all decide we're nuts and check ourselves into Central State?"
"What big casino might that be, Yoda?"
Don asked.
"The JFK assassination," Robbie said. "Mr. Tolman says that was the seminal event of the 20th century, even more important than the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. I thought seminal events usually happen in bed, but hey, I came to college to learn. Mr. Tolman's in the history department."
"I know who Hugh Tolman is," Don said. "He's a goddamn commie and he never laughs at my jokes."
"But he could be right about the Kennedy assassination," Wesley said. "Let's look."
They pursued the John Kennedy in Dallas thread until nearly 11 o'clock, while college students hooted unnoticed below them on their way to and from the local beer pits. They checked over 70 versions of the New York Times for November 23, 1963. And although the story was never the same, one fact seemed undeniable to all of them. Whether he missed Kennedy, wounded Kennedy, or killed Kennedy, it was always Lee Harvey Oswald, and he always acted alone.
"The Warren Report was right," Don said. "For once the bureaucracy did its job, I'm gobsmacked."
In some errors, that day in November had passed with no assassination stories, either attempted or successful. Sometimes Kennedy decided not to visit Dallas after all. Sometimes he did, and his motorcade was uneventful. He arrived at the Dallas Trademark, gave his $100-a-plate luncheon speech.
"God, things were cheap back in the day, weren't they?"
Robbie remarked, and flew off into the sunset. This was the case in 88,416. Wesley began to plug in more dates from that What he saw filled him with awe and horror and wonder and sorrow. In 88,416, Kennedy had seen the folly of Vietnam and had pulled out over the vehement objections of Robert McNamara, his Secretary of Defense. McNamara quit and was replaced by a man named Bruce Palmer, who resigned his rank of U.S. Army General to take the job. The civil rights turmoil was milder than when Lyndon Johnson was president, and there were almost no riots in the American cities, partly because in 88,416, Martin Luther King wasn't assassinated in Memphis or anywhere else. In this JFK was elected for a second term. In 1968, Edmund Muskie of Maine won the presidency in a landslide over Nelson Rockefeller. By then, the outgoing president was hardly able to walk without the aid of crutches and said his first priority was going to be major back surgery. Robbie ignored that and fixed on a story that had to do with Kennedy's last White House party. The Beatles had played, but the concert ended early when drummer Pete Best suffered a seizure and had to be taken to Washington, D.C. hospital.
"Holy shit,"
Don whispered.
"What happened to Ringo?"
"Guys," Wesley said, yawning, "I have to go to bed. I'm dying here."
"Check one more," Robbie said. 4,121,989.
It's my birthday, gotta be lucky. But it wasn't. When Wesley selected the and added a date, January 20, 1973, not quite at random, what came up instead of enjoy your selection was this. No times this after November 19, 1962.
Oh my God, Wesley said, and clapped a hand to his mouth. Dear sweet God.
What? Robbie asked. What is it?
I think I know, Don said. He tried to take the pink Kindle.
Wesley, who guessed he had gone pale, but probably not as pale as he felt inside, put a hand over Don's.
No, he said. I don't think I can bear it.
Bear what? Robbie nearly shouted.
Didn't Hugh Tolman cover the Cuban Missile Crisis? Don asked. Or didn't you get that far yet?
What missile crisis? Was it something to do with Castro?
Don was looking at Wesley.
I don't really want to see either, he said. But I won't sleep tonight unless I make sure, and I don't think you will either.
Okay, Wesley said, and thought, not for the first time either, that curiosity, rather than rage, was the true bane of the human spirit.
You'll have to do it, though. My hands are trembling too much.
Don filled in the fields for November 19, 1962. The Kindle told him to enjoy his selection, but he didn't. None of them did. The headlines were stark and huge. NYC toll surpasses 6 million. Manhattan decimated by radiation. Russia said to be obliterated. Losses in Europe and Asia incalculable. Chinese launch 40 ICBMs.
Turn it off, Robbie said in a small, sick voice. It's like that song says, I don't want to see no more.
Don said,
Look on the bright side, you two. It seems we dodged the bullet in most of the errors, including this one.
But his voice wasn't quite steady.
Robbie's right, Wesley said.
He had discovered that the final issue of the New York Times in 4,121,989 was only 3 pages long, and every article was death.
Turn it off. I wish I'd never seen that damn thing in the first place.
Too late now, Robbie said. And how right he was. They went downstairs together and stood on the sidewalk in front of Wesley's building. Main Street was almost deserted now. The rising wind moaned around the buildings and rattled late November leaves along the sidewalks. A trio of drunk students was stumbling back toward Fraternity Row, singing what might have been Paradise City.
I can't tell you what to do. It's your gadget. But if it was mine, I'd get rid of it, Don said. It'll suck you in.
Wesley thought of telling him he'd already had this idea, but didn't.
We'll talk about it tomorrow.
Nope, Don said. I'm driving the wife and kids to Frankfurt for a wonderful 3-day weekend at my in-laws. Susie Montanari's taking my classes. And after this little seminar tonight, I'm delighted to be getting away. Robbie, drop you somewhere?
Thanks, but no need. I share an apartment with a couple other guys 2 blocks up the street over Susan and Nan's place.
Isn't that a little noisy? Wesley asked. Susan and Nan's was the local cafe and opened at 6 a.m. 7 days a week.
Most days I sleep right through it, Robbie flashed a grin. Also, when it comes to the rent, the price is right.
Good deal. Night, you guys.
Don started for his tercel, then turned back.
I intend to kiss my kids before I turn in. Maybe it'll help me get to sleep. That last story.
He shook his head.
I could have done without that. No offense, Robbie, but stick your birthday up your ass.
They watched his diminishing taillights, and Robbie said thoughtfully,
Nobody ever told me to stick my birthday before.
I'm sure he wouldn't want you to take it personally, and he's probably right about the Kindle, you know. It's fascinating. Too fascinating, but useless in any practical sense. Robbie stared at him, wide-eyed.
You're calling access to thousands of undiscovered novels by the great masters of the craft useless? Jesus, what kind of English teacher are you?
Wesley had no comeback, especially when he knew that, late or not, he'd probably be reading more of Cortland's Dogs before turning in. "Besides," Robbie said, "it might not be entirely useless. You could type up one of those books and send it into a publisher. You ever think of that? You know, submit it under your own name, become the next big thing. They'd call you the heir to Vonnegut or Roth or whoever." It was an attractive idea, especially when Wesley thought of the useless scribbles in his briefcase. But he shook his head. "It'd probably violate the paradox laws, whatever they are. More importantly, it would eat at me like acid from the inside out." He hesitated, not wanting to sound prissy, but wanting to articulate what felt like the real reason for not doing such a thing. "I would feel ashamed." The kid smiled. "You're a good dude, Wesley." They were walking in the direction of Robbie's apartment now, the leaves rattling around their feet, a quarter moon flying through the wind-driven clouds overhead.
"You think so?"
"I do.
And so does Coach Silverman."
Wesley stopped, caught by surprise.
"What do you know about me and Coach Silverman?"
"Personally, not a thing, but you must know Josie's on the team. Josie Quinn from class?"
"Of course I know Josie," the one who'd sounded like a kindly anthropologist when they'd been discussing the Kindle. And yes, he had known she was a lady meerkat. Unfortunately, one of the subs who usually got into the game only if it was a total blowout.
"Josie says Coach has been really sad since you and her broke up. Grouchy, too. She makes him run all the time and kicked one girl right off the team."
"That was before we broke up."
Thinking, in a way, that's why we broke up.
Does the whole team know about us?"
Robbie Henderson looked at him as though he were mad.
"If Josie knows, they all know."
"How?" Because Ellen wouldn't have told them. Briefing the team on your love life was not a coachly thing to do.
"How do women know anything?" Robbie asked. "They just do."
"Are you and Josie Quinn an item, Robbie?"
"We're going in the right direction."
"Good night, Wes. I'm going to sleep in tomorrow. No classes on Friday. But if you drop by Susan and Nance for lunch, come on up and knock on my door."
"I might do that," Wesley said.
"Good night, Robbie. Thanks for being one of the Three Stooges."
"I'd say the pleasure was all mine, but I have to think about that."
Instead of reading Hemingway when he got back, Wesley stuffed the Kindle in his briefcase. Then he took out the mostly blank bound notebook and ran his hand over its pretty cover. "For your book ideas," Ellen had said. And it had to have been an expensive present. Too bad it was going to waste. "I could still write a book," he thought. "Just because I haven't in any of the other errs doesn't mean I couldn't hear." It was true. He could be the Sarah Palin of American letters, because sometimes long shots came in, both for good and for ill. He undressed, brushed his teeth, then called the English department and left a message for the secretary to cancel his one morning class.
"Thanks, Marilyn. Sorry to put this on you, but I think I'm coming down with the flu."
He added an unconvincing cough and hung up. He thought he would lie sleepless for hours, thinking of all those other worlds. But in the dark, they seemed as unreal as actors when you saw them on a movie screen. They were big up there, often beautiful too, but they were still only shadows thrown by light. Maybe the worlds were like that too. What seemed real in this post-midnight hour was the sound of the wind, the beautiful sound of the wind telling tales of Tennessee, where it had been earlier this evening. Lulled by it, Wesley fell asleep, and he slept deeply and long. There were no dreams, and when he woke up, sunshine was flooding his bedroom. For the first time since his own undergraduate days, he had slept until almost 11 in the morning.
5. Local, under construction.
He took a long hot shower, shaved, dressed, and decided to go down to Susan and Nan's for either a late breakfast or an early lunch, whichever looked better on the menu. As for Robbie, Wesley decided he'd let the kids sleep. He'd be out practicing with the rest of the hapless football team this afternoon. Surely he deserved to sleep late. It occurred to him that if he took a table by the window, He might see the athletic department bus go by as the girls set off for the Bluegrass Invitational 80 miles away. He'd wave. Ellen wouldn't see him, but he'd do it anyway. He took his briefcase without even thinking about it. He ordered the Susan's Sexy Scramble, onions, peppers, mozzarella cheese, with bacon on the side, along with coffee and juice. By the time the young waitress brought his food, he'd taken out the Kindle and was reading Cortland's Dogs. It was Hemingway, all right, and one terrific story.
"Kindle, isn't it?" the waitress asked. "I got one for Christmas, and I love it. I'm reading my way through all of Jodi Picoult's books."
"Well, probably not all of them," Wesley said.
"Huh? Why not?"
"She's probably got another one done already, that's all I meant."
"And James Patterson's probably written one since he got up this morning,"
she said, and went off, chortling. Wesley had pushed the main menu button while they were talking, hiding the Hemingway novel without really thinking about it. Feeling guilty about what he was reading? Afraid the waitress might get a look and start screaming, "That's not real Hemingway?" Ridiculous. But just owning the pink Kindle made him feel a little bit like a crook. It wasn't his, after all, and the stuff he had downloaded wasn't really his either, because he wasn't the one paying for it. Maybe no one is, he thought, but didn't believe it. He thought one of the universal truths of life was that, sooner or later, someone always paid. There was nothing especially sexy about his scramble, but it was good. Instead of going back to Cortland and his winter dog, he accessed the menu. The one function he hadn't peeked into was Local, which was under construction. What had Robbie said about that last night? Better watch out, traffic fines double. The kid was sharp, and might get even sharper if he didn't batter his brains out playing senseless Division III football. Smiling, Wesley highlighted Local and pushed the select button. This message came up. "Access current location? Y, N." Wesley selected Y. The Kindle thought some more, then posted a new message. "The current local is More Echo. Access? Y, N." Wesley considered the question while eating a strip of bacon. The Echo was a rag specializing in yard sales, local sports, and town politics. The townies scanned those things, he supposed, but mostly bought the paper for the obituaries and police beat. Everybody liked to know which neighbors had died or been jailed. Searching 10.4 million more Kentucky-ers sounded pretty boring. But why not? Wasn't he basically marking time, drawing his breakfast out so he could watch the player's bus go by? "Sad but true," he said, and highlighted the Y button. What came up was similar to a message he had seen before. Local is protected by all applicable paradox laws. Do you agree? Y, N. Now that was strange. The New York Times archive wasn't protected by these paradox laws, whatever they were, but their pokey local paper was? It made no sense, but seemed harmless. Wesley shrugged and selected Y. "Welcome to the Echo Pre-Archive. Your price is $40, 4 downloads, $350, 10 downloads, $2,500, 100 downloads. Wesley put his fork on his plate and sat frowning at the screen. Not only was the local paper Paradox Law protected, it was a hell of a lot more expensive. Why? And what the hell was a pre-archive? To Wesley, that sounded like a paradox in itself, or an oxymoron. "Well, it's under construction," he said. "Traffic fines double, and so do download expenses. That's the explanation. Plus, I'm not paying for it." No, but because the idea persisted that he might someday be forced to, someday soon, he compromised on the middle choice. The next screen was similar to the one for the Times archive, but not quite the same. It just asked him to select a date. To him, this suggested nothing but an ordinary newspaper archive, the kind he could find on microfilm at the local library. If so, why the big expense? He shrugged, typed in July 5th, 2008, and pushed select. The Kindle responded immediately, posting this message. "Future dates only. This is November 20th, 2009. For a moment, he didn't get it. Then he did. and the world suddenly turned itself up to super bright, as if some supernatural being had cranked the rheostat controlling the daylight. And all the noises in the cafe, the clash of forks, the rattle of plates, the steady babble of conversation, seemed too loud.
"My God," he whispered. "No wonder it's expensive."
This was too much, way too much. He moved to turn the Kindle off, then heard cheering and yelling outside. He looked up and saw a yellow bus with Moore College Athletic Department printed on the side. Cheerleaders and players were leaning out the open windows, waving and laughing and yelling stuff like, "Go Meerkats!" and "We're number one!" One of the young women was actually wearing a big foam number one finger on her hand. The pedestrians on Main Street were grinning and waving back. Wesley lifted his own hand and waved feebly. The bus driver honked his horn. Flapping from the rear of the bus was a piece of sheeting with "Meerkats will rock the Rup" spray-painted on it. Wesley became aware that people in the cafe were applauding. All this seemed to be happening in another world. Another. When the bus was gone, Wesley looked down at the pink Kindle again. He decided he wanted to utilize at least one of his 10 downloads after all. The locals didn't have much use for the student body as a whole, the standard town versus gown thing, but they loved the Lady Meerkats, because everybody loves a winner. The tourney's results, preseason or not, would be front-page news in Monday's Echo. If they won, he could buy Ellen a victory gift, and if they lost, he could buy her a consolation present. "I'm a winner either way," he said, and entered Monday's date, November 23rd, 2009. The Kindle thought for a long time, then produced a newspaper front page. The date was Monday's date. The headline was huge and black. Wesley spilled his coffee and yanked the Kindle out of danger, even as lukewarm coffee soaked his crotch. 15 minutes later, he was pacing the living room of Robbie Henderson's apartment while Robbie, who'd been up when Wesley came hammering at the door, but was still wearing the t-shirt and basketball shorts he slept in, stared at the screen of the Kindle. "We have to call someone," Wesley said. He was smacking a fist into an open palm and hard enough to turn the skin red. "We have to call the police. No, wait, the arena. Call the Rup and leave a message for her to call me ASAP. No, that's wrong. Too slow. I'll call her now. That's what..."
"Relax, Mr. Smith.
Wes, I mean..." "How can I relax? Don't you see that thing? Are you blind?"
"No, but you still have to relax. Pardon the expression, but you're losing your shit, and people can't think productively when they're doing that."
"But..." "Take a deep breath and remind yourself that according to this, we've got almost 60 hours. Easy for you to say. Your girlfriend isn't going to be on that bus when it starts back to..."
Then he stopped. Because that wasn't so. Josie Quinn was on the team, and according to Robbie, he and Josie had a thing going on.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I saw the headline and freaked. I didn't even pay for my breakfast, just ran up here. I know I look like I wet my pants, and I damn near did, not with coffee either. Thank God your roommates are gone."
"I'm pretty freaked too," Robbie admitted. And for a moment, they studied the screen in silence.
According to Wesley's Kindle, Monday's edition of The Echo was going to have a black border around the front page, as well as a black headline on top of it. That headline read, "Coach, 7 students killed in horrific bus crash, 9 others critical." The story itself wasn't a story at all, only an item. Even in his distress, Wesley knew why. The accident had happened, no, was going to happen. At just short of 9 p.m. on Sunday night, too late to report any details, although probably if they heated up Robbie's computer and went to the internet, what was he thinking? The internet did not predict the future, only the pink Kindle did that. His hands were shaking too badly to enter November 24th. He pushed the Kindle to Robbie. "You do it." Robbie managed, though it took him 2 tries. The Echo's Tuesday story was more complete. But the headline was even worse. "Death toll rises to 10. Town and college mourn."
"Is Josie?"
Wesley began.
"Yeah," Robbie said. "Survives the crash. Dies on Monday. Christ."
According to Antonia Tony Burrell, one of the Meerkat cheerleaders and one of the lucky ones to survive Sunday night's horrific bus crash with only cuts and bruises, the celebration was still going on, the bluegrass trophy still being passed hand to hand. "We were singing We Are the Champions for the 20th time or so," she said from the hospital in Bowling Green, where most of the survivors were taken. "Coach turned around and yelled for us to keep it down, and that's when it happened."
According to State Police Captain Moses Arden, the bus was traveling on Route 139, the Princeton Road, when an SUV driven by Candy Reimer of Montgomery struck it.
"Ms. Reimer was traveling at a high rate of speed west along Highway 80, Captain Arden said, and struck the bus at the intersection.
The bus driver, Herbert Allison, 58, of Moore, apparently saw Ms. Reimer's vehicle at the last moment and tried to swerve. That swerve, coupled with the impact, drove the bus into the ditch, where it overturned and exploded. There was more, but neither of them wanted to read it.
"Okay," Robbie said. "Let's think about this. First, can we be sure it's true?"
"Maybe not," Wesley said, "but Robbie, can we afford to take the chance?"
"No," Robbie said. "No, I guess we can't.
Of course we can't, but Wes, if we call the police, they won't believe us, you know that.
We'll show them the Kindle. We'll show them the story."
But even to himself, Wesley sounded deflated.
"Okay, how about this? I'll tell Ellen. Even if she won't believe me, she might agree to hold the bus for 15 minutes or so, or change the route this guy Allison's planning to take."
Robbie considered.
"Yeah, worth a try."
Wesley took his phone out of his briefcase. Robbie had gone back to the story, using the next page button to access the rest. The phone rang twice, three times, four. Wesley was preparing to deliver his message to voicemail when Ellen answered.
"Wesley, I can't talk to you now. I thought you understood that. Ellen, listen. But if you got my message, you know we're going to talk."
In the background, he could hear raucous, excited girls. Josie would be among them, and lots of loud music.
"Yes, I did get the message, but we have to talk
No, Ellen said.
"We don't. I'm not going to take your calls this weekend, and I'm not going to listen to your messages."
Her voice softened.
"And, hon, everyone you leave is going to make it harder. For us, I mean."
"Ellen, you don't understand.
Goodbye, Wes. I'll talk to you next week. Do you wish us luck?"
"Ellen, please."
"I'll take that as a yes," she said. "And you know what? I guess I still care about you, even though you are a lug."
With that, she was gone.
He poised his finger over the redial button, then made himself not push it. It wouldn't help. Ellen was wearing her My Way or the Highway hat. It was insane, but there it was.
"She won't talk to me except on her schedule. What she doesn't realize is that after Sunday night, she may not have a schedule. You'll have to call Miss Quinn."
In his current state, the girl's first name escaped him.
"Josie'd think I was pranking on her," Robbie said. "A story like that, any girl would think I was pranking on her."
He was still studying the Kindle screen.
"Want to know something? The woman who caused the accident, who will cause it, hardly gets hurt at all. I bet you next semester's tuition she was just as drunk as a goddamn skunk."
Wesley hardly heard this.
"Tell Josie that Ellen has to take my call. Have her say it's not about us. Tell her to say it's an emer-"
"Dude," Robbie said, "slow down and listen. Are you listening?" Wesley nodded, but what he heard most clearly was his own pounding heart.
Point one, Josie would still think I was pranking on her. Point two, she might think we both were. Point three, I don't think she'd go to Coach Silverman anyway, given the mood that Coach has been in lately. And she gets even worse on game trips, Josie says.
Robbie sighed.
You have to understand about Josie. She's sweet, she's smart, she's sexy as hell, but she's also a timid little mousie. It's sort of what I like about her.
That probably says heaps of good things about your character, Robbie, but you'll pardon me if right now I don't give a tomcat's ass. You've told me what won't work. Do you have any idea what might?
That's point four. With a little luck, we won't have to tell anybody about this. Which is good, since they wouldn't believe it.
Elucidate?
First, we need to use another one of your echo downloads.
Robbie punched in November 25th, 2009.
Another girl, a cheerleader who had been horribly burned in the explosion, had died, raising the death toll to 11. Although the echo didn't come right out and say so, more were likely to die before the week was out. Robbie only gave this story a quick scan. What he was looking for was a boxed story on the lower half of page one. Candace Reimer charged with multiple counts of vehicular homicide. There was a gray square in the middle of the story. Her picture, Wesley assumed, only the pink Kindle didn't seem able to reprint news photographs. But it didn't matter, because now he got it. It wasn't the bus they had to stop. It was the woman who was going to hit the bus. She was point four. 6. Candy Reimer. At 5 o'clock on a gray Sunday afternoon, as the Lady Meerkats were cutting down basketball nets in a not-too-distant part of the state, Wesley Smith and Robbie Henderson were sitting in Wesley's modest Chevy Malibu, watching the door of a roadhouse in Eddyville, 20 miles north of Cadiz. The parking lot was oiled dirt and mostly empty. There was almost certainly a TV inside the broken windmill, but Wesley guessed discriminating tipplers would rather do their drinking and NFL watching at home. You didn't have to go inside the joint to know it was a hole. Candy Reimer's first stop had been bad, but this second one was worse. Parked slightly crooked and blocking what appeared to be the fire exit was a filthy, dinged-up Ford Explorer with two bumper stickers on the back. "My child is an honor student at the state correctional facility," one read. The other was even more succinct. "I break for Jack Daniels." "Maybe we ought to do it right here," Robbie said, "while she's inside slopping it up and watching the Titans." It was a tempting idea, but Wesley shook his head. "Well, wait. She's got one more stop to make. Hobson, remember?"
"That's miles from here."
"Right," Wesley said. "But we've got time to kill, and we're gonna kill it."
"Why?"
"Because what we're up to is changing the future, or trying to at least. We have no idea how tough that is. Waiting as long as possible improves our chances."
"Wesley, that is one drunk chick. She was drunk when she got out of that first juke joint in Central City, and she's going to be a lot drunker when she comes out of yonder shack. I can't see her getting her car repaired in time to rendezvous with the girl's bus 40 miles from here. And what if we break down while we're trying to follow her to her last stop?"
Wesley hadn't considered this. Now he did. "My instincts say wait, but if you have a strong feeling that we should do it now, we will."
"The only strong feeling I have is a scared to freaking death feeling," Robbie said. He sat up. "Too late to do anything else anyway. Here she comes, Miss America."
Candy Reimer emerged from the broken windmill in a moderate weave. She dropped her purse, bent down to get it, almost fell over, cursed, picked it up, laughed, and then continued to where her Explorer was parked, digging her keys out as she went. Her face was puffy, not quite hiding the remains of what must once have been very good looks. Her hair, blonde on top and black at the roots, hung around her cheeks in lank curls. Her belly pooched out the front of elastic waist jeans, just below the hem of what had to be a Kmart smock top. She got into her beat-to-shit SUV, kicked the engine into life, it sounded in desperate need of a tune-up, and drove forward into the roadhouse's fire door. There was a crunch. Then her backup lights came on, and she reversed so fast that for one sickening moment, Wesley thought she was going to hit his Malibu, crippling it and leaving them on foot as she drove off toward her appointment in Samara. But she stopped in time and peeled onto the highway without pausing to look for traffic. A moment later, Wesley was following as she headed east towards Hobson and the intersection where the Lady Meerkat's bus would arrive in 4 hours. In spite of the terrible thing she was going to do, Wesley couldn't help feeling a little sorry for her, and he had an idea Robbie felt the same. The follow-up story they'd read about her in the Echo told a tale as familiar as it was sordid. Candace Candy Reimer, age 41, divorced, 3 children, now in the custody of their father. For the last 12 years of her life, she'd been in and out of spin-dry facilities,
According to an acquaintance, she seemed to have no friends, she had tried AA and decided it wasn't for her. Too much holy rolling. She had been arrested for DUI half a dozen times. She had lost her license after each of the last two, but in both cases, it had been restored, the second time by special petition. She needed her license to get to her job at the fertilizer factory in Bainbridge, she told Judge Wallenby. What she didn't tell him was that she had lost the job 6 months previous, and nobody checked. Candy Reimer was a booze bomb waiting to go off, and the explosion was now very close. The story hadn't mentioned her home address in Montgomery, but it didn't need to. In what Wesley considered a rather brilliant piece of investigative journalism, especially for the Echo, the reporter had retraced Candy's final binge, from the Pot of Gold in Central City to the broken windmill in Eddyville to Bandy's Bar in Hobson. There, the bartender was going to try to take her keys, unsuccessfully. Candy was going to give him the finger and leave, shouting, "I'm done giving my business to this dive," back over her shoulder. That was at 7 o'clock. The reporter theorized that Candy must have pulled over somewhere for a short nap, possibly on Route 124, before cutting across to Route 80. A little further down 80, she would make her final stop. A fiery one. Once Robbie put the thought in his head, Wesley kept expecting his always trusty Chevrolet to die and coast to a stop at the side of the two-lane blacktop, a victim of either a bad battery or the paradox laws. Candy Reimer's taillights would disappear from view, and they would spend the following hours making frantic but useless calls, always assuming their phones would even work out here in the Willywags, and cursing themselves for not disabling her vehicle back in Eddyville while they still had a chance. But the Malibu cruised as effortlessly as always, without a single gurgle or glitch. He stayed about half a mile behind Candy's Explorer.
"Man, she's all over the road," Robbie said. "Maybe she'll ditch the damn thing before she gets to the next bar, save us the trouble of slashing her tires."
"According to the Echo, that doesn't happen."
"Yeah, but we know the future's not cast in stone, don't we? Maybe this is another error or something."
Wesley didn't think it worked that way with local, but he kept his mouth shut. Either way, it was too late now. Candy Reimer made it to Banty's without going in the ditch or hitting any oncoming traffic, although she could have done either. God knew she had enough close calls. When one of the cars that swerved out of her way passed Wesley's Malibu, Robbie said,
"That's a family. Mom, Pop, three little kids goofing around in the back."
That was when Wesley stopped feeling sorry for Reimer and started feeling angry at her. It was a clean, hot emotion that made his peek at Ellen feel paltry by comparison. "That bitch," he said. His knuckles were white on the steering wheel. "That drunken, who-gives-a-shit bitch. I'll kill her if that's the only way I can stop her."
"I'll help,"
Robbie said, then clamped his mouth so tightly shut his lips nearly disappeared. They didn't have to kill her, and the paradox laws stopped them no more than the laws against drinking and driving had stopped Candy Reimer on her tour of southern Kentucky's more desperate watering holes. The parking lot of Banty's Bar was paved, but the buckling concrete looked like something left over from an Israeli bombing raid in Gaza. Overhead, a fizzing neon rooster flashed on and off. Hooked in one set of its talons was a moonshine jug with XXX printed on the side. The Reimer woman's Explorer was parked almost directly beneath this fabulous bird, and by its stuttering orange-red glow, Wesley slashed open the elderly SUV's front tires with the butcher knife they had brought for that express purpose. As the whoosh of escaping air hit him, he was struck by a wave of relief so great that at first he couldn't get up, but only hunker on his knees, like a man praying. "My turn," Robbie said. And a moment later, the Explorer settled further as the kid punctured the rear tires. Then came another hiss. He had put a hole in the spare for good measure. By then, Wesley had gotten to his feet.
"Let's park around to the side," Robbie said. "I think we better keep an eye on her."
"I'm going to do a lot more than that," Wesley said.
"Easy, big fella. What are you planning on?"
"I'm not planning. I'm beyond that."
But the rage shaking through his body suggested something different. According to the Echo, she had called Banties a dive in her parting shot. But apparently that had been cleaned up for family consumption. What she actually threw back over her shoulder was, "I'm done doing business with this shit pit." Only by this point she was so drunk, the vulgarity came out in a slippery slur.
Shit pit.
Robbie, fascinated at seeing the news story played out before his eyes, right down to the upraised middle finger, which the Echo had primly referred to as an obscene gesture, made no effort to grab Wesley as he strode toward her. He did call, "Wait!" but Wesley didn't. He seized the woman and commenced shaking her. Candy Reimer's mouth dropped open. The keys she'd been holding in the hand not occupied with bird flipping dropped to the cracked concrete tarmac.
"Let me go, you bastard!"
Wesley didn't. He slapped her face hard enough to split her lower lip, then went back on her the other way. "Sober up!" he screamed into her frightened face. "Sober up, you useless bitch! Get a life and stop fucking up other people's! You're gonna kill people! Don't you understand that? You are going to fucking kill people!" He slapped her a third time, the sound as loud as a pistol shot. She staggered back against the side of the building, weeping and holding her hands up to protect her face. Blood trickled down her chin. Their shadows turned into elongated gantries by the neon bird, winked off and on. He raised his hand to slap a fourth time, better to slap than to choke, which is what he really wanted to do, but Robbie grabbed him from behind and wrestled him away. "Stop it! That's enough!" The bartender and a couple of goofy-looking patrons were now standing in the doorway, gawking. Candy Reimer had slid down to a sitting position. She was weeping hysterically, her hands pressed to her swelling face.
"Why does everyone hate me?"
she sobbed.
"Why is everyone so goddamn mean?"
Wesley looked at her dully, the anger out of him. What replaced it was a kind of hopelessness. You would say that a drunk driver who caused the deaths of at least 11 people had to be evil. But there was no evil here. Only a sobbing alky sitting on the cracked, weedy concrete of a country roadhouse parking lot. A woman who, if the off-and-on light of the stuttering rooster did not lie, had wet her pants.
"You can get the person, but you can't get the evil," Wesley said. "The evil always survives. Isn't that a bitch? Just a total bitch."
"Yeah, I'm sure, but come on, before they get a really good look at you." Robbie was leading him back to the Malibu. Wesley went as docilely as a child. He was trembling.
"The evil always survives, Robbie.
In all the errs. Remember that."
"You bet, absolutely. Give me the keys. I'll drive."
"Hey!" someone shouted from behind them.
"Why in the hell did you beat up that woman? She wasn't doing nothing to you. Come back here!"
Robbie pushed Wesley into the car, ran around the hood, threw himself behind the wheel, and drove away fast. He kept the pedal down until the stuttering rooster disappeared, then eased up.
"What now?"
Wesley ran a hand over his eyes.
"I'm sorry I did that," he said. "And yet, I'm not. Do you understand?"
"Yeah,"
Robbie said.
"You bet. It was for Coach Silverman and Josie, too."
He smiled.
"My little mousie."
Wesley smiled.
"So where do we go, home?"
"Not yet," Wesley said. They parked on the edge of a cornfield near the intersection of Route 139 and Highway 80, 2 miles west of Cadiz. They were early, and Wesley used the time to fire up the pink Kindle. When he tried to access local, he was greeted by a somehow unsurprising message. This service no longer available.
"Probably for the best," he said.
Robbie turned toward him.
"Say what?"
"Nothing, it doesn't matter." He put the Kindle back in his briefcase.
"Wes?"
"What, Robbie?"
"Did we break the paradox laws?"
"Undoubtedly," Wes said, and with some satisfaction. At 8:55, they heard honking and saw lights. They got out of the Malibu and stood in front of it, waiting. Wesley observed that Robbie's hands were clenched, and was glad he himself wasn't the only one still afraid that Candy Reimer might still somehow appear.
Headlights breasted the nearest hill. It was the bus, followed by a dozen cars filled with Lady Meerkat supporters, all honking deliriously and flashing their high beams off and on. As the bus passed, Wesley heard young female voices singing, "We Are the Champions," and felt a chill race up his back and lift the hair on his neck. He raised his hand and waved. Beside him, Robbie did the same. Then he turned to Wesley, smiling.
"What do you say, Prof? You want to join the parade?"
Wesley clapped him on the shoulder. "That sounds like a damn fine idea." When the last of the cars had passed, Robbie got in line. Like the others, he honked and flashed his lights all the way back to Moore. Wesley didn't mind.
7. The Paradox Police. When Robbie got out in front of Susan and Nan's, where Lady Meerkat's rule had been soaped on the window, Wesley said, "Wait a sec." He came around the front of the car and embraced the kid.
"You did good."
"Ungrammatical, but appreciated."
Robbie wiped at his eyes, then grinned.
"Does this mean I get a gift A for the semester?"
"Nope. Just some advice.
Get out of football. You'll never make it a career, and your head deserves better."
"Duly noted," Robbie said, which was not agreement, as they both knew. "See you in class?"
"On Tuesday," Wesley said.
But 15 minutes later, he had reason to wonder if anyone would see him. Ever again. There was a car in the spot where he usually left the Malibu when he didn't leave it in parking lot A at the college. Wesley could have parked behind it, but chose the other side of the street instead. Something about the car made him uneasy. It was a Cadillac, and in the glow of the arc sodium beneath which it was parked, it seemed too bright. The red paint almost seemed to yell, "Here I am. Do you like me?" Wesley didn't, nor did he like the tinted windows or the oversized gangsta hubcaps with their gold Cadillac emblems. It looked like a drug dealer's car. If, that was, the dealer in question also happened to be a homicidal maniac. Now, why would I think that? "Stress of the day, that's all," he said, as he crossed the deserted street with his briefcase banging against his leg. He bent down. Nobody was inside the car. At least, he didn't think so. With the darkened windows, it was hard to be entirely sure. "It's the Paradox Police. They've come for me." This idea should have seemed ridiculous at best, a paranoid fantasy at worst, but felt like neither. And when you considered all that had happened, maybe it wasn't paranoid at all. Wesley stretched out a hand, touched the door of the car, then snatched it back. The door felt like metal, but it was warm, and it seemed to be pulsing, as if metal or not, the car were alive. Run. The thought was so powerful he felt his lips mouth it, but he knew running wasn't an option. If he tried, the man or men who belonged to the loathsome red car would find him. This was a fact so simple that it defied logic. It bypassed logic. So instead of running, he used his key to open the street door and went upstairs. He did it slowly, because his heart was racing, and his legs kept threatening to give way. The door of his apartment stood open, light spilling onto the upstairs landing in a long rectangle.
Here you are,
a not-quite-human voice said.
Come in, Wesley of Kentucky.
There were two of them. One was young, and one was old. The old one sat on his sofa, where Wesley and Ellen Silverman had once seduced each other to their mutual enjoyment, nay, ecstasy. The young one sat in Wesley's favorite chair, the one he always ended up in when the night was late, the leftover cheesecake tasty, the book interesting, and the light from the standing lamp just right. They both wore long mustard-colored coats, the kind that are called dusters, and Wesley understood, without knowing how he understood, that the coats were alive. He also understood that the men wearing them were not men at all. Their faces kept
changing, and what lay just beneath the skin was reptilian or bird-like or both. On their lapels, where lawmen in a Western movie would have worn badges, both wore buttons bearing a red eye. Wesley thought these two were alive. Those eyes were watching him.